Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 15th, 2006. Our session today is titled Intelligent Design and Flood Geology. Our presenter is Steve Gremesh, session number GRS 2006-2. Let's listen in.
That was the signal to start. I know everybody's tired from the last session, and so what I want to do today is to pick up where we left off yesterday with kind of a little bit of a narrative of some of the sort of the trajectory of the development of Western science, then stop after that and explore a couple of questions that we left unanswered yesterday or partially answered, and then go into some of the particulars of flood geology. Now, I'll explain a little bit more about that in a minute. I think most people are familiar with the intelligent design debate, sort of the general features of it. But I think, and this sort of came about from some conversations that I had with colleagues some years ago, that what we call flood geology is probably a little bit more dangerous in terms of the integrity of science. And as I mentioned yesterday to those that were here, for me it's personal because I teach high schoolers science. I don't teach them biology and I don't teach them earth science. I happen to teach them chemistry. But I am the chairman of a science department. And so while I'm not overly concerned that the District of Columbia is going to insert intelligent design standards into their program, to which I have to adhere, it's still bothering me a little bit. And it's bothering me on a number of different levels. And so hopefully we can talk a little bit about that. Yeah.
Can you define what you mean by intelligent design?
Well, I kind of go along with, I accept what the sort of standard definition is, which is that the idea at least starts with the premise that the natural world and human beings in particular, the living world, is so complex that it cannot have been the result of chance events like evolution. And that's pretty much the basic idea. I mean, if you distill it down into its basic features, you have all the offshoots, the standards, the sort of what kids are supposed to know about the flaws of Darwinian evolution, for example. But when you distill it all down, that's pretty much the premise. The offshoot of that, of course, happens to be that kids in science class ought to be exposed to the flaws in Darwinian evolution as a theory and be told that since it's not a complete theory, then it's perfectly reasonable to expose them to other theories. That saying that intelligent design is a theory, however, is problematic, because as we talked about yesterday, it really can't be a theory. It can't be a theory because its first principles are not grounded in observation, scientific observation, or data, or conclusions that are supported by data. Any scientific theory has to have a first principle. And its first principle has to be rooted in observation, observation that is repeatable or an experiment that is repeatable and is agreed upon. It doesn't have to be a law necessarily. There's many, many theories that that we work with in science, in the physical sciences, that are not laws at all. But they're well tested. They're well confirmed by others, and eventually one of or more of them may become scientific laws. Certainly possible. I suppose there's a group of people and who suggest that the physical laws that govern the universe have been discovered. We know what they are. It's just working out the consequences. That's the activity of science, which that's okay by me. You know, I think the consequences are just as fun as the laws. You know, but I tend to be a more blue-collar type of scientist. You know, where I like to get in there and get my fingers dirty and do experiments and teach kids and, you know, that kind of thing, as opposed to, you know, publish a lot of papers and be famous. I mean, I don't think that's ever going to happen, so I'm okay with it. That's good. Does that answer your question? I'm sorry, it was such a long answer. How about you? What do you think? What do you think intelligent design is?
Well, I was more interested in, you know, what the debate is, what the particular topics were. I still think that there are parts of science where, in that classic cartoon where they have all these equations on the board and then they have a little line and then a miracle occurs and they get the answer.
Right.
That there's still parts that we don't have thoroughly explained.
And yeah.
We need to be open to what those are. But again, as you say, they haven't been, it's not a true scientific theory. It is simply a concept.
Well, I think the proponents of intelligent design actually shoot themselves in the foot a lot because they advance what's known as the God in the Gaps model or explanation, where there's something that is not explained. For example, biochemical evolution, sort of the idea that life on this planet started out as small molecules that got together to create bigger molecules, that got together to create molecules which would transfer information. The steps of that are not even close to being all worked out. The general idea, and this is how scientific theory starts, the general idea is proposed, and there's guideposts along the way which are well-tested, well-confirmed results. And as I mentioned yesterday, colleagues of mine in my own laboratory are working on this. I don't work on it because it's not my bag, but people are working every day at filling in those gaps. But where the scientific community will say, we understand these gaps, we know these gaps are there, we think this is what's happening, but we don't know. That's why we're doing experiments. We have a hypothesis, we're going to design an experiment to test that hypothesis, to prove whether it's right or wrong, and then we'll move on based on the results of that hypothesis. On the other hand, the sort of creationist type of camp will say, well, they'll first say, that's a flaw in your theory because you don't have it completely worked out. Now, to me, that's irrational. But, and at the same, sort of in the same breath, they'll say, well, we have it worked out. That's God in the gaps. You know, God put that in there. I mean, you'll be amazed. I have a little letter that was written to, a letter to the editor of a journal that is astounding and basically says the same thing. Now, my overall problem with all of this is on a number of different levels, and I think many people share the kind of sort of, well, I think most people would look in the newspaper and kind of be amused at all of this, but And some people may be upset and angry, and you know, it depends where you live and what your experience is, I think. But for me, one level is the level I just mentioned, and that is, what about our kids? You know, I mean, is that right to do that to our kids in school? To say, you're learning this in science, it's science. Is that right? Is that fair? Is that just for them? You know, so that's one level that kind of makes me a little upset. I mentioned that I don't really have any problems with the District of Columbia, but I do have a little bit of worry about Virginia. You know, I happen to live in Virginia where my kids go to school. My daughter is 9, and, you know, who knows what they might do in Virginia. You know, they do have, they have chipped away at the issue of school prayer now and again. So there's things there that bother me on that level, but it also bothers me on the level of faith, and which is, to me, and its sentiments are echoed by a number of people, is that this kind of activity, this kind of intellectual, I use that term loosely, of course, this kind of effort is something that dilutes not only science, but it dilutes faith. And that's something that we alluded to yesterday. A gentleman over here was saying, well, what happens when you fill in all those gaps? Does God become irrelevant? Is God going to become irrelevant to the intelligent design people? Well, I guess I'm not as worried about that as just that faith becomes trivialized, and it's kind of happening in our country in a number of ways, that faith just becomes this sort of general rubric for people who are fanatical or intolerant of one of a long-term or sort of long view of science. I mean, that kind of bothers me too, as a Christian. You know, so I mean, I can't. Those aren't things I'm going to talk about in my AP chemistry class, but they still matter, you know. And whether we like it or not, you know, those things are here, I guess. Were there any other comments on that? Yeah.
It seems like there's a third alternate. You're saying it if the God of gaps is, you know, if they find the chemical equation, then it's irrelevant. But even if they don't, what kind of a God do you really have? I mean, a God mm-hmm. of a chemical equation that it's not. I mean, there again, it's a problematic in the faith because even if it's not provable in that sense, it's not. It's certainly not the Christian God that
sure.
out there at all. It's
yeah. Yeah, I agree, and I'm not an authority in those kinds of matters, sort of the theological end of it. I know what I feel like as a practicing scientist who also has a strong faith and you know tries to live by that. It does. It bothers me to see it trivialized that way by, you know, people as high up in our government as the President of the United States. I mean, and some people would disagree with that, certainly, yeah.
I want to then add a piece. I think it's important because I happen to be aware there's a survey that's been going on for 100 years that has been carried on recently that it deals with what do scientists believe about God.
Mm-hmm.
And the survey itself, when it was formulated, asked the question in two parts. It's kind of this creator-type God. But the other part is a God that you pray to on a daily basis, asking for sustenance.
Yeah.
And it is that second question that the scientists in the surveys are rejecting. And how much it changes over time is interesting. But the part that's in the key that they're making the point about is that the core scientists, the best scientists of all, the ones that are getting the awards at Nobel Prize level or that, they are rejecting especially the idea of a God that you pray to every day. That part of it. And most of us, or at least I am a part of the people, and I consider myself a scientist, but I, part of the people that I think of the Christian God as somebody that you pray to.
Yeah.
Or, you know, as, not a body, a person, but it is something that that you can have a daily prayer relationship with. And that is apparently difficult for core scientists to accept, that I gather.
Yeah, don't you think, though, maybe that that's sort of reflective of a trend in society in general?
It's been this, the survey is, yes, and the survey says that the trend has been, I don't know what it was like, only maybe there was 30 or 40% of them at 1900.
Yeah.
But by the late 1970s or 1980s, it was down to like only 5% of them would accept that kind of a God. And so
yeah,
it's really, it may be a trend, but it is.
It's certainly.
It's an important issue, though, I think, when we say what kind of a God are we talking about.
It's certainly reasonable to assume that in the scientific community, those numbers are going to be higher than in the general population, I would think. But yeah.
I'm just curious about the survey, because in my 20 years as a basic scientist, and in my laboratory, we're all spiritual in our different ways. And
oh, yeah.
I don't think for a second I'd actually ever encountered anyone
I
who
doesn't
have
data.
A faith base. But I've certainly never met anybody who's agnostic or atheistic.
Have you ever read of anybody?
Yeah. I mean, Jerry Vogel's probably the most outspoken
Watson.
One. But I mean,
Trick.
I can certainly say that within recent years, Linda Buck is a very strong Christian.
Yeah.
I mean, there's certainly examples within recent years, and, it's just not something that I see, and I certainly don't ever see it really debated one way or another.
I feel comfortable in the sense that if you move away from that top tier, the Watson, the Crick, the Nobel Prize winners, and other major prize winners, which are at the top of scientific leadership, that it drops, it's like 50 or 60%. So there that are that way. So I felt comfortable in that, because I'm certainly way down there in terms of that part. So I think there's a lot of good scientists, and I run into a lot of scientists in my day in, day out activities that are Christian, and there's a lot of them in our churches. But the issue was that the very top level of science, the ones that are pushing the envelope and bringing the theories to us and bringing it into mathematical form, it starts to get rarefied on how many will believe in that kind of a God.
Well,
is that a problem?
Yeah. Where is the issue?
I mean, it's certainly, I think it could be, you know, a sad thing. You know, one might look at it, but I'm asking kind of, yeah, whether it's a problem.
It may not be a problem, so
leave
it.
Sure,
it's not a problem. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I think it is a bit of a generalization to say that all core scientists, but maybe a lot more in the past few years. But and again, if you're just going to say more core scientists are not believing in God, and then you go to make them try to believe in your God, that just proves a lot of scientists, core scientists' point that a lot of it is very obsessive. Christianity, like for those who are really obsessive Christians, it can be obsessive, and that's why they're not dealing with it.
Possibly, yeah, sure.
Well, and I think that this does get a little bit to the intelligent design debate, because I don't know why we feel the need to dichotomize when a dichotomy doesn't necessarily exist.
Oh, sure. Yeah, and that's one thing that I tried to bring out yesterday with some of the people, or some of the early scientists that we discussed, was that there never was. I mean, they fully admitted that there was a religious dimension in their work, and that it was sort of axiomatic that there was a prime mover or a craftsman or whatever you want to call the creator who set this whole thing in motion. And depending on your belief, maybe that creator is still in there pulling the strings daily. Who knows? But science is not addressing that issue. Science is addressing describing this and, you know, when, where, why, how things happened and took place. And you're exactly right. They're and I think in most most scientists' opinions, who believe in that creator, there doesn't have to be, certainly. There's no reason for it. You know, it makes things, like I said, it to me, at least, in my own opinion, it dilutes both. When you try to pit them against each other, it's pointless. I mean, but we do that in society for meaningless reasons all the time. Yeah, you had a comment.
I'm not sure. I think I'm kind of taking off of what you just said. It seems to me like maybe the fundamental issue is whether or not you are thinking of theological truth and scientific truth as two sides of the same shape, or two fundamentally different truths altogether. If you can separate those, and I don't know. It like for me, whether or not the earth was created or how it was created is not an issue. I mean, that's not the meaning that I draw from the first chapters of Genesis. And I guess, I don't know what I'm trying to say, but
that doesn't really have that much meaning.
I'll tell you what.
Curiosity.
Yeah, sure. I'll tell you what we tell our students, some of whom come from extremely religious families. As a matter of fact, I had a young woman in my class last year whose mother wanted to remove her from the class because it was an elective, and she didn't have to take AP Chemistry, and her mother was afraid that there were going to be things that conflicted with their faith, which was a sort of a Baptist type of very, I don't know what you call it, but very fundamentalist type of view, that science inherently was evil. And the only reason she took general science and biology and chemistry in the first 3 years was because she had to graduate from this school, and she would have had to do that anywhere. But the parents were absolutely opposed in all respects to their daughter being in a science class. Now,
you don't even talk about anything intelligent design in your class at all, though.
Well, let's just put it this way. I didn't promote it, but I did mention the debate. And you should, I mean, she was extremely upset by the whole thing, you know. But what we try to tell our students there is that, look, there are two realms of knowledge here. Okay, there's a realm of knowledge that has to do with faith, how you know certain things are true, how you know about redemption or the resurrection or grace or whatever it is that you believe in. And then there's also a realm of knowledge that has to do with the natural world. And you can't use the techniques and the methods of one to try to investigate the other one. Unfortunately, what we have in some of the things that I'm going to talk about a little bit later is exactly that.
And that's where I think the problem is I feel like a lot of people with a more fundamentalist approach to the Bible might think of there only being one realm of truth. And you know what I mean?
And by default, that truth has to be the biblical truth.
Exactly. And if you're using a tool that starts to deconstruct that truth and to shape the foundation of the truth, then obviously it's not a correct tool, or it's not, you're deviating from the truth then, because there is
right.
And so I guess where I feel is, or I guess my understanding of like people who are, I mean, I'm not a scientist, but people who do have a scientific background and do have a faith, is that they tend towards this, like what you were describing, this kind of idea that there are different truth sets that maybe don't even really intersect or interact. Does that make sense?
Sure. I mean, there's one could argue that there's different ways of knowing about the natural world too, mm-hmm. right? There's one way where you could take a camera out and take pictures of it, or you could paint it, or you could do something else. For example, you could sculpt or whatever.
Record sounds.
Sure, whatever you want. You know, write poetry about it. Okay, that's a way of knowing about the natural world. It's just not science. That's all, and that's okay. There's truths there that are personal truths. Mm-hmm. Okay, the scientific method is going after the physical truth, the actual mechanism whereby things happen. And I guess where it really becomes a problem is because inherently that truth that science seeks to uncover through the scientific method is a truth that is, well, once it's discovered, is not disputable, you know? I mean, really. I mean, for example, we understand that there's gravity, and that is a law, a physical law in the universe, and it's not disputable. And the mechanism by which gravity happens is not disputable. Now, one could, I mean, if you go, that's the sort of macroscopic view. The actual reasons for gravity are still under some debate. People think there's gravity waves or bends in the space, you know, time continuum or something like that. And they all vary various different things, but the effects of gravity are not in dispute. And we can calculate it, you know, with Newton's laws. It's pretty easy. So, anyway, you had a comment.
Well, I was just thinking about, you know, the laugh or cry of the flat earth, if I'm not wrong, some days ago, both scientists and Christians were certain that was the case.
Oh, sure.
You know, so I tend to laugh in some ways about all this.
Yeah, science hasn't got it all. They do get there eventually, usually. But when I was a kid, we were taught the atom was the smallest thing there ever was. That's not so.
Yeah, no, it's not.
So, but that's what we were told. Yeah.
Well, sure, and that's what's exciting about it to me. You know, I mean, and the fact that you can keep up with it and try to understand it and move along with it, and that's what's exciting on a day-to-day basis, I think, about science.
So Gabe's got an advantage on all of us. He's going to learn some things that none of us are going to live long enough to hear that come out of science.
Sure.
Is that what you felt like when you were little?
Well, I thought we were learning everything, but when they taught me about the atom, I believed them. And it wasn't until I started eating electronics that I found out they weren't telling me the truth.
Well,
they told you what they knew at the time.
That's right. But
we
still
have that.
That's what we've got in both these trends here. We only got what we know so far, and that's what I was saying yesterday.
Well, and it depends on what you're talking about. I'm, of course, now I'm being a teacher. It depends on what you're talking about in terms of the smallest thing. You know, I mean, are you talking about the smallest particle, or were they talking about the smallest identifiable piece of matter?
Okay.
If you're talking about the smallest identifiable piece of matter, then yes, that's still true.
Till the end.
Yeah, well, they were very plain. That was the very smallest thing there was.
Yeah.
Nothing about qualifying it so that you could make it right.
Yeah.
What do we need to do to get to flood geology?
Oh, I've got to stop talking. Okay, so. I guess I got a
point back there.
What's that?
You got a point back there.
Maybe hit the space bar?
Yeah, just hit the space thing there. I think it'll come back. At least I hope.
Or maybe the control.
There we go.
Yeah. Okay, so what we were talking about yesterday was this idea that the medieval period saw a really very significant decline in scientific activity. And what most people did was compile results or translate the results of the classical period, the classical Greek and Roman period. And so to keep these things alive. And the church, in some small way, was responsible for that. And I think it's kind of remarkable, actually, that you actually had the church supporting the work of these scribes to translate these things. And the works of Plato and Aristotle became part of what was called the scholasticism, or scholastic movement, in the late Middle Ages, and we're talking about now almost 2,000 years of scholarship or work in this area, whether it's actual work or whether it's transcribing the work. I think that's remarkable, you know. And so the church, I think, gets a bad rap sometimes in this sort of early medieval period for not being supportive of science, but they weren't all bad about it. And again, they were supporting the work of Plato and Aristotle, who were living in polytheistic, societies. I mean, but it was important enough. And of course, it had the Earth as the center of the universe, which, was a big thing. That's it? Right. Yeah. Now, one of the things that's fascinating is that what really kept science alive was work in the East, specifically in the Persian Empire. And this diagram right here is, you can see the Arabic written there. The resolution's not great, but you can still make it out. But what this is a diagram of how the eye works. One of the things that these Persian and sort of from the Islamic world, what they worked on really was their big focus was the human body. And some of these guys turned out to be fantastic physicians and really made significant advances in the understanding of anatomy and the understanding of disease processes. And aside from that, they were also learning the works of Aristotle and keeping that alive through this period. On the right over here is once again a diagram of the cosmos with the Earth at the center. The idea was, okay, well, we're still going to work on this. It turns out to be, of course, one of the most important things that anybody was working on, the cosmos. How does it all work? How does it all, fit together? And where is the place of the human being in that cosmos, or the Earth, actually? And so you can see, compared to some of the diagrams we showed yesterday, this whole thing is getting very, very complex, even more complex than it was yesterday, with trying to work out all of the various motions of the planets, the retrograde motion of certain planets at certain times, and, but it's great work, It's not the truth, but it's great work. And it was a very exciting time to work. Yeah.
And also, that's the same thing with evolution. They could be all wrong about everything that they're doing, but it's great work what they're doing to find out.
I agree.
Very good.
Good point. Okay, so anyway, two of my favorites in this whole area were on the left, both of these guys have names that are about, 30 names long. But the sort of short form and then the anglicized form are shown here. Avicenna was a Persian. He came, in the 10th century. And a physician exhausted the resources of all of his teachers by the time he was 14. Became a physician at age 16, became completely disillusioned with Aristotle because he couldn't make it out. He just couldn't understand it. Metaphysics just wasn't his game. But he was the son of a nobleman, and so both of these guys actually wound up in the court of the noble, whoever they were, guys of those times. And so he was a physician, and then one day he goes to a book bazaar, a book sort of fair, and he picks up a a commentary in Latin by somebody on Aristotle's Metaphysics. Reads it, figures the whole thing out, and then he starts writing commentaries. And so once again, we're talking about people in the medieval period keeping the information alive, or keeping sort of the interest in it, the commentary, sort of building up scholarship, if you will. Which, and then of course, you know, in Poland, he was honored with his own stamp, which, you know, Poland. I mean, you could think Iran or Iraq or something like that, but Poland, he was honored with his own stamp. Now the other guy over here, Averroes, was a similar type of individual, although he was a nobleman up way up there. I mean, he turned out to be he was sort of a freelance scholar, could do whatever he wanted, and did a lot of studying. He wasn't the physician type like Avicenna. Avicenna was a guy who really worked. But this guy was more of a traveler, you know, and went about and tried to find out what other people were learning and what they were knowing. But he wrote a very, well, and then of course it's later on in the period, right? We're talking about the 12th century now. And things get a little heated with these traveling itinerant, you know, teachers talking about Aristotle and Plato. One of the religious sort of fundamentalist type people of the time wrote a book called The Incoherence of the Philosophers, which was an attack on Plato and Aristotle because it conflicted with Muslim truth as found in the Quran. Does that sound familiar at all? Anywhere? Okay. Well, so, but what Averroes did was, I mean, he, and this probably wouldn't be such a good idea today, but he wrote a book, his own book, called The Incoherence of the Incoherence. Sort of getting back at the religious establishment. But again, he was very, very interested in medicine and very interested in astronomy and sort of the general important sciences of the time.
Who's that person down there? The second picture.
Well, this is him.
What's he doing?
I don't. But well, in this particular picture, this is a fresco by Raphael, by the way. I didn't put the acknowledgement down there. I should have done that. But no, what he's actually doing here is he's watching a surgical procedure. So, which just, you know, fits along with what he did. He went about, you know.
He's like holding his heart or dying or something.
No, I think he's just
leaning over.
Well, you know, it's your own interpretation.
He's trying to keep his clothes from getting into the scene of the surgery.
Or maybe he's just amazed, you know. He's just happy to be there.
Yeah.
But again, this actually, well, he was from a different part of the Muslim world, the area of Spain, Morocco, that kind of thing. But an amazing individual. And so these are two of my favorite guys, you know, from this period. But again, the important thing about both of these individuals was that they continued to assert the separation between religious faith and scientific inquiry. You know, and there wasn't so much of that sort of in anatomy and physiology or things like that. There was a little bit, but not so much religious doctrine governing the scientific method there. They were pretty much exploring, and okay, you cut open a person and there's where the heart is, and there's where the lungs are, and that's that, you know. So, but that's what they did, and they were amazing individuals. So now we come to the real deal here with Galileo. Now, I love these pictures of him. It turned out that his troubles began when he was a reasonably young man. And most people know the sort of general outlines of this, but Galileo is widely considered to be the founder of modern science. Now, that can be construed in various ways, but in terms of a rigorous application of the emerging scientific method, that is, hypothesis, experiment, analysis, conclusions, whether they proved or disproved the hypothesis. And of course, he was mostly interested in the motions of the planets. Made his own telescope, and because he was able to make his own telescope, started to really get some hard scientific data on the motions of the planets. And that conflicted with the sort of traditional wisdom of the day that the Earth was the center of the universe and that everything else revolved around it. Lo and behold, if you put the sun at the center of our own solar system, all of these retrograde motions start working out perfectly, and that was the view that was held by Copernicus. And so he got himself into a little bit of trouble with the Inquisition, was forced to renounce his position on the motion of the planets. And I know I'm giving a very broad brush thing here, but some of you probably know more about this than me. But the quotation here that is attributed to Galileo, I think, is fantastic. And it kind of gets to the heart of the matter. I do not feel obliged to believe that the same God, small g, by the way, who has endowed us with sense, reason, and intellect, has intended us to forgo their use. That's it, right? That's it in a nutshell. Okay? And so what we have here is sort of the first celebrated instance of the church being at odds with the scientific record. Now, why?
We're afraid of it.
What did the church have to lose by a greater understanding of the physical world? I got to believe that there were people in the church at that time, I mean, I don't know about the history of it, but I got to believe that there were people in the church at that time who said, oh, well, that's pretty neat. You know, somebody decided that this was not going to be the way it was going to be.
Probably the highest person in office at the church at that time.
I agree. Well, but, you know, he put the clamps on Galileo. What's that?
Prove the fallibility of the church, or pointed to the possible fallibility of the church.
Yeah, but you're right, and that's the reason why Galileo had all his troubles.
But it's probably going to point to something like the belief that the Pope is infallible or something and can't make a mistake.
Well, did the Pope actually believe Aristotle and Socrates and their sort of planetary cosmos?
But if you're infallible, you can't switch your opinion. So if you've ever expressed that this is not so, and before you know more about it, you can't change if you're infallible.
Why did he have to be infallible?
Well, that's their belief, that the Pope is infallible. They believe it today.
Yeah.
I wonder if it doesn't have to do partly with fear that if this thing that's reading the Genesis text in a pre-scientific understanding, it's really clear that the center of all of this God's activity is the creation of human beings.
Right.
And that there's a fear that if you knock the center, if you take that pin and knock it apart, then everything will lose coherence and spin out of control.
Right, God's creation is not what we thought it was. It's not the center of the universe. It's not...
Yeah. And therefore, all kinds of things about, and there's a lot of the slippery slope theory.
Yeah, sure.
We lose we lose everything.
Why couldn't they have said, and this is purely rhetorical question, why couldn't they have said, oh, well, maybe the Earth is the center of the universe instead, instead of our own little thing. I mean, couldn't they have said that? That would have been nice, I suppose. Maybe they didn't understand about the universe, But okay, so anyway, it was closed-minded type of thing.
See, they've already said that.
Right.
they've already said that the earth is the center of everything that is.
Yeah.
It's the center focus of all of God's creative energy. And the center focus of all that is human beings. And I think, personally, I think that's at the heart of this debate, is that the fear that it really is that the debate is about whether human beings are the core, central, most important thing that God has ever done, and therefore the center of all that creative activity, or are we just like everything else? And I think at the heart of it is, when I hear intelligent design, is that it's really androcentric. It sounds like it's putting God at the center, but it's really the fear that human beings aren't at the center.
That's a good point.
And that God may actually have done creation and had us be part of the process rather than the focus of the process. But,
And I think along those lines, it's the loss of belief as a continuum, and we look at things as a dominion question, that if we're to be seen as the center, we suddenly have dominion over the earth. Mm-hmm. And whatever we do, we have license to do. And during the same period, were huge debates. In fact, the church started to put a ban on dissection because there are huge debates about formation of life. Yeah. And it was freely believed that male ejaculate contained fully formed human beings, and women but were nothing but receptacles for those. And there were people that, as they did dissection, saying, well, I'm not really seeing any of these fully formed human beings. I don't know where they are, but they're not in anything we can find, that they started to ban dissection and said, well, you can't do that anymore because you're disturbing the order of the universe and so forth and so on. And so people started to, at that time, say, well, maybe it has something to do with the matching up of male and female that starts to orchestrate this. But I think, it wasn't just questions of what was the center of the universe. It was also really questions about creation of life that led into this.
Okay, one more, and then we got to move to non-intelligent design.
I think this is a different point of view. I think the issue, which was sort of led to a little bit, was who was the authority. I think that was the issue.
Uh-huh.
And I'll illustrate that in a way. But the issue in the question there, it's which group of humans were right. Were the church right, or were these scientists right?
Yeah.
And let me illustrate it, because I can be Monday morning quarterback of the 21st century. And the question might be phrased in this thing: is the earth the center of the universe, or is the sun the center of the universe? And the two sides sat there and fought it out, to the nail, to the death, to which one is going to be able to say which answer is right. Now, we all know, I think, in this room, in the 21st century, that the sun is not the center of the universe. It's not even the center of the Milky Way galaxy. I mean, so
it's just one step.
But the scientists won by over the church, saying that the sun is more the center than is the earth at that point. I think the debate is back on the table again now of which is more important: the hydrogen-helium fusion system of stars, or these systems that have all the 92 elements and can sustain life. I mean, so it's back on the table again. But back then, they had it toe-to-toe, a wall of hostility between two human authorities to decide who's in control here, and the church lost.
I guess some things never change. Two human societies or groups. Okay, so, all right. I'm sorry about this. I thought this would be okay.
Would you turn the light on?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Feel the lights on. Go over
here. No, it helps.
That's better.
That's good.
Yeah, I'll switch that background and.
Oh, that's better.
Okay, so, creation science. Now, and it's actually kind of interesting that the. Does anyone have to turn these off?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. Okay, thank you. So the creationism or creation science used to be, and this is not all that long ago either. It used to be a well-used term. But then the sort of the political determination that that was not going to get that stuff into the schools forced these people to back off and to adopt other terms, such as intelligent design. Flood geology is one of the creation science sort of avenues. And that turns out to be a perspective where the absolute total truth of the Great Flood, the fact that it existed, the fact that it's as it was in described in Genesis, that it covered the whole earth, is the central feature here. And then, of course, intelligent design. Here's the definition of intelligent design by what's known as the Discovery Institute, Center for Science and Culture, that certain features of the universe and of living things best describe an intelligent cause and not random processes, undirected or random processes, such as natural selection, mutation, and that. Now, the thing about it that's common between both of these is that, and these are two different things, actually. One is that the Bible is a source of scientific information, that, you know, it's in there. Everything is in there. You just have to get it out. You just have to figure out a way to extract that truth. So, in fact, there's no real need for science, right? If all the truth is in there, okay, so the quote, science of creation scientists is to look for information which corroborates or shows that, or matches up with the Bible, okay? The scientific information is in there. Secondly, that there is a timeline for creation. This turns out to be the big deal. The timeline for creation is laid out according to Genesis. This is called the Young Earth Perspective. And the timeline was laid out in 1656, I think, by an archbishop by the name of Usher, who decided that the universe was formed on October the 23rd, 4004 BC. That's exactly true.
11:40 in the morning.
You know, that's it. There, October the 23rd, 4004 BC, that's the start of the universe. And a lot of people, there's still people around who, scientists who believe that.
Can I make one comment about the first thing up there?
Sure.
If you go back to the beginning of geology, for a long period, there were people who were trying to show that the evidence of the surface of the earth was supportive of the flood geology.
Yes.
And they struggled, and they struggled,
right,
and they struggled, and they struggled, and finally effectively gave up because you couldn't.
Right, exactly. And I was actually going to get to that in a minute. But that picture in the corner is a garnet. Nice picture to look at.
I actually want to say something about Usher because it gets brought up a lot in this discussion.
Yeah.
If Usher were a scientist instead of whatever he's considered to be.
A churchman.
But whatever, if he were a scientist,
oh, right,
what would happen in the discussion, in the scientific discussion, is you would say, how did you arrive at your data? And he said, well, I went through the genealogy in the Bible and I took a certain length of time for how long each one of these generations could live, and I went back to the first generation, and I arrived at how many years that was,
right,
and that's the answer. And the scientists would then say, well, did you use carbon-14 dating? And he said, no, I based mine on this evidence.
Right.
Well, then the scientific community would say, well, we'll use carbon-14 dating, we'll use your stuff, we'll use this, we'll use that, and we will see if everything all fits together. So science would not have a problem with Usher. But somehow in this debate, Usher becomes a problem. And that I think we need at some level to start talking about. Why is using the genealogy in the Bible to try and set a time span, what's wrong with that?
Well, fundamentally nothing except that it's not a source of scientific information.
It doesn't give the best answer to science, I think.
Right, it's a source problem, I think. You know, Okay, so anyway, there's the common aspects of this thing, and
why is it guarded up there?
What's that?
Why was it guarded up there?
Because it's a nice picture. Well, if you were at my thing this morning, I was explaining all this stuff. Those little pictures that I have there are, and the reason I have them on there is because one turns out to be important in, I think, the next slide. Those are diagrams of the actual internal atomic level structure of minerals. The first one was the garnet. This one is a mica. So this is kind of what I do for a living, and I work at sort of working out the positions of these atoms in there by a technique called X-ray diffraction. And there's what these represent are sort of polyhedra which house a certain type of atom in the center. It turns out to be a really good way of simplifying a very complex arrangement of atoms. Well, anyway, so the origins of flood geology, people were starting to talk about flood geology in the second century and discovering fossils and deciding, well, okay, this is evidence. These fossils are preserved in there. These animals died, these plants died, and they were buried by these sediments and because of the flood. But of course, it was not possible up until the 17th century to actually do some experiments on this. And what was developed was known as natural theology. Instead of natural philosophy, which sort of was the term for science, this is natural theology. And natural theology, the goal of that was to take a view that the Bible had the answers. The history of recording the Bible provided all the information. Two people, contemporaries, Woodward and Whitson, in the 1690s, put out books that were representative of this. But very soon afterwards, in a matter of 100 and some years, the basic principles of geology started to be laid out because people actually got around and they started observing. And James Hutton, a Scotsman, Charles Lyell, an Englishman, I believe, at that time the age of the Earth was determined to be at least 75,000 years. The kind of dating procedures that we have now were not available, of course. But the other thing was that the ideas of Newton started to become important. Newton was less than a century before Hutton and Lyell, and his ideas about sort of the physical forces which govern the universe were taken into account here. But I must say that Lyell and Hutton were much more sort of broad thinking. Newton was talking about surface processes and the cosmos and the kind of the forces which govern them. Uniformitarianism of Hutton and Lyell was more concerned with the Earth, but it encompassed everything. And so what the idea was that the processes that are taking place right now are the same processes that have been going on for as long as there has been an Earth or a cosmos. Earth in the case of geology, the cosmos in the case of everything else. And so the first real geology textbook of any real import was the text of William Buckland, the Reverend William Buckland, by the way, the first geology professor at the University of Oxford, and wrote a book called Geology and Mineralogy, considered with reference to natural theology. I kind of like that term. Considered with reference to, which basically he laid down some very serious objections to the idea of natural philosophy. But I must say that he still was of the opinion that science could be used to understand God's creation. His sort of theological point of view as a minister in the church, came through in his science. which was nice. It was elegant, I thought. Anyway, so if you want to, I've got about 5 more minutes here. I'll take you through the last thing that I have here. So, flood geology, the Great Flood. Okay, the basic mechanism of the Great Flood was that there was this vapor canopy. This was kind of the sort of the long-standing mechanism here. There was a vapor canopy above the earth, sort of represented by these little dots and everything. And then you have the earth in the green. But not only that, okay, so rain fell, according to the Bible, the rain fell for 40 days. And then the water continued to rise for 100 days more. So where did that water come from? Well, the water that was locked deep inside the earth was allowed to come to the surface through these fissures in the crust, in the in the body of the earth, and so that's how it happened. All that water to cover the entire earth was stored inside the earth. Now, it turns out that if you take this vapor canopy idea, if you calculate the amount of water that's required for this to be stored in the atmosphere to deluge the earth, what you're looking at is 9 atmospheres of pressure. 9 atmospheres. Basically, an entire earth covered with a steam pressure cooker. It's 600 degrees Fahrenheit, steam. You know, the pressure was really high, so you'd think it was being liquefied, but the temperature was so high that it was still a gas, and this was the atmosphere.
Oh. Now, how do you know that Noah, they just thought it was all the earth, but really, since they thought the earth was so much smaller back then, it was only a little part of the earth that they knew about?
You've got a good point.
Well, yeah, you do. But I think in any case, the earth is still going to be really, really big.
I agree with what he just said, because Genesis tells us how big the earth is. And the rivers, apparently, are still around that they document for how big it is. And it isn't all that big. It's from the Nile River over to Tigris and Euphrates. It's a relatively... I don't think it included the floods that we had here in Washington State, for instance. I don't think it would have made it into the biblical account of the flood.
Yeah.
A lot of folks will interpret the Bible that way, but the intelligent design creation science people say that you can't interpret the Bible that way because it says the whole earth was covered.
I got you. Okay.
And the Bible must be right, and so that's got to be the mechanism.
The Bible isn't always right.
Oh, well,
oh, now we have...
That's easy for you to say, it's hard for us to say it, but for other folks, that's very difficult for them.
Be careful now.
You're a young Lutheran, and that's
I think you really hit hard at the bait.
That's all they knew when they talked about the Adam was the smallest thing.
Yeah.
And then when they knew more, I learned more. But that can be the same in that flood. The only land that they knew was all covered.
Well,
and that was what they considered the earth. Because I think people back then thought all the earth was flat, and they didn't believe in North America.
Well, okay, but all right. You're right.
You're right.
But
that's true.
So
but in fact,
don't like to hear that.
But in fact, they can say that. All right, they can say that. And if the earth from the Nile to wherever it is out in Central Asia somewhere is covered, then everything else is covered too. Right? And so if the earth is covered, the earth is covered. Right? I mean,
yeah. Well,
no matter how big it is,
they witnessed
it's still
to
covered.
What they saw. They can't witness to what they can't see.
Right, but they said the earth was covered. And so what we're talking about here is the implication of that,
right,
which is what you're saying there.
So the all entire, not part of it could be covered, all of it would have to be covered?
But we haven't got enough products, the water and stuff, to cover all of it. So we can only cover so much of it. So it makes sense that they only looked at so much of it.
Okay.
That was in the details.
So anyway, this vapor canopy turns out to have something like 9 atmospheres of pressure and a steam bath, and there's no evidence for that in the scientific record. But
is that negative 600 degrees?
Approximately 600 degrees. Not negative.
It's curvy.
It's a curvy thing.
It's a curvy line, not a straight line.
You'll get that. You'll get that geometry. Okay, wait till eighth grade. So the vapor canopy thing has been discounted by the creationists or the flood geology community. There's no more the idea of the flood, or the vapor canopy. They've abandoned it. But and why have they abandoned it? Of course, because it's untenable. But they still have this idea of the release of trapped water. Now, there's various guises of this, and you can go and you can read all about it. The other shoe may drop. Okay, it's been recently discovered in our laboratory that the hydrous minerals in the mantle, that is from the crust to the core of the earth, contain these hydrous minerals contain enough water to approximately account for 3 oceans worth of water. So if you take all the water on the surface of the earth, the 75% of the earth that's covered with water, and you multiply that by 3, the entire volume now, the whole thing, the entire volume, you multiply that by 3, that's how much water is stored in the hydrous minerals of the mantle. Now, so that's a scientific fact, by the way.
Yeah.
Has passed the peer review thing. It was actually just presented at our lab. Part of it was done last summer. Part of it was done this summer. But the big news here is that it definitely affects the Earth's water budget, the cycling of water. Cycling of minerals and things like that through the mantle. Now, it'll be interesting to see what happens when the creation or the flood geology people grab onto that
one. Yeah, but what would it take to drive the water constituent out of those hydrous minerals?
Right. Well, what happens is it's trapped in there, and at normal atmospheric pressure and temperature, those minerals dehydrate.
Let's see if it was a huge... different kind of atmospherical pressure could be threatening to Noah's life and everybody in the Ark's life.
I guess I'm not sure what you're telling me.
I think he's trying to say that everything in the atmosphere where they were had changed. They would be in danger too. If we've got a very limited atmosphere in which we can live.
Yeah.
Is that a long thing?
Well,
is that what you meant?
It's definitely, but it's something to think about, actually, and that's why I put it up there, and that's why I put those little pictures up there to get you.
You're leaving us hanging. What's the material?
Well, if
there was a mechanism to put those 3 oceans worth of water on the surface, filling the oceans with the given amount of height of the continents above the ocean, would it flood the earth?
I have no idea.
I mean, someone must have done the balance so they know how many tons or however you measure huge amounts of water, how much an ocean weighs.
Yeah.
Is 3 oceans of water on top of the current ocean, which I think brings us to 4 oceans of water, is that enough to flood all the continents? I don't know.
Well, the continents are less than the ocean.
Yeah, I know. They're only about...
I'll see if I can't work it out.
I mean, we have to know.
Okay.
Make
tomorrow, please.
I'll see if I can't work it out. Okay, so, I'm going to have to do some very, very severe approximations.
Because I've got something like
this,
you go prove it to us.
I've got no... that's kind of cool about science, see? Okay, the last thing, I have a couple of more. We can talk about this tomorrow, but there's the big problem here is what we call the time problem. Okay, now there's certain scientific facts associated with flood geology, and they recognize the facts just like the normal scientific community does because it's an observation. You can't change the observation. The observation is there. And one of those observations is the existence of sedimentary rocks, which cover approximately 80% of the Earth's crust, which is a lot. And the so what do we do? The question is, what does the scientific community do with that information? What does the flood geology community do with that information? And what the flood geology community says, well, okay, we've got all of these, you know, huge currents of water and suspended material and all kinds of rocks and everything else being completely torn apart by this great flood. And they come together as the waters recede and deposit these sediments. And everybody's seen sedimentary rocks. You know, you drive along through the mountains or something, you see these huge sediments just, you know, crushing together. But remember now, the flood geology premise is that it took place over the space of 1 year. 1 year for all this stuff to happen, all these sediments to be laid down, all this other, you know, the flood waters to recede, everything. The observation is we have rigidly defined strata. You can look at it. And if you look at it very, very closely, you'll find that there's almost no mixing of these depositing fluids. I mean, you know, you've got one strata laid down, and it solidifies. Another comes in top of it, solidifies. And there's very little mixing between the two. There might be some, but very, very little. Now, what's the time problem? The time problem is that if you have this, all this stuff happening in 1 year, if you look at rock-fluid mixtures, there's not going to be time for them to dry out before they stratify. That's the time problem. And it's always the time problem. Here's another one. Fossil fuel formation. The simple fact is that both camps agree with the observation that you have decayed organic matter that was once living in underneath sedimentary rocks. That's down there. Now, the problem is that what does one camp do with that information? What does the other camp do with that information? You have degraded matter. You have many, many fractions of, you know, oil and solid stuff down there. What happens is that you have all this living matter, and there's a process. There's a chemical reduction process where it is degraded. You have lithostatic pressure, you have high temperature that's resulting from all these degrading processes, and you get all these different fractions of decayed organic matter, fossil fuels. Now, where's the time problem? The time problem happens where this chemical process cannot happen in 1 year. It's scientifically proven that that process, if left by itself, is going to take approximately 50 million years to complete. Not one, but 50 million. Again, we have the time problem. The last thing I want to talk about today, and we can go over this tomorrow if you want to and talk more about it. I know that I hope I'm not keeping you from dinner. Is radioisotope dating. And most of you know about carbon-14 dating. What you do is you have a certain fraction of every organic material, you, me, the wood, whatever it is giving off, is decaying away. It's decaying from carbon-14. A certain amount of the carbon atoms in your body are carbon-14. They are decaying away to nitrogen-14 by emitting radioactivity. It's comforting, isn't it? And over time, the percentage of that goes down. Okay, so over about 5,000 years, the carbon-14, once the material stops living, the material will contain half the carbon-14 that it had before. We can measure that. It's easy. And so, again, it's the time problem. Now, the point is that if you deny the validity of carbon-14 dating, then you have to agree that the speed of light has changed over the last 5,000 years.
How much?
Good question. A lot.
A lot.
A lot.
Not a very good answer.
Requires a suspension of physical laws. Last question, yeah.
Well, and I guess I haven't really thought of this now, but the ID community spends a lot of time debating the finding of nucleic acids throughout the fossil fuel formation record.
Right.
So they say the DNA that we find in tunicate larvae buried down at 30 million years sedimentation rates,
is not the nucleic acids of current time, that all happened kind of as a byproduct of massive water shifts and changes. I guess I hadn't even thought of this by now, but our very good current estimates as to how we deal with DNA damage and repair would say that they would have to accept isotope damaging as a byproduct of a short period of time that no creature on Earth could ever compensate for in their nucleic acids. So we could survive. It'd be the equivalent of dropping millions of atomic bombs expecting species to survive. Because that's the only way you could have decay over that period of time and account for most of our DNA damage and repair enzymes.
Okay.
Because they could coexist.
Good point. Anyway, so that's a quick run through. We can talk a little bit more about it tomorrow if you want to. And I think we're going to talk about the Earth's core tomorrow. So we'll see you then. Thanks for coming.